Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Platypus, the extraordinary story of how a curious creature baffled the world by Anne Morrell, a absolutely ripping, a gripping story, and as I think it's the next episode, I can't quite remember which one it is. Oh, it's chapter 14. I'm slowing down a little bit, but doing sequential podcasts here to get the time up. And as is beautifully written, there's quotes of other books at the start. John Luke Cates, 5 Days in London, May 1940, written in 1999. Having expressed himself in writing clearly and fully about the subject, Churchill was inclined to think that the matter was accomplished, largely done. He was not aware of the obstacles of bureaucracy. A special label affixed to the papers and directives marked action of the day. So this is Churchill wading in for his platypus. David Fielding's success with Jack and Jill in Healesville since the late 1930s was widely known before the adventurous exploit of the American in 1947. At the heart of the war, the British Prime Minister Winston Churchill was clearly aware of it. As 43 dawned, developments in World War II challenged on every front. Churchill and US President Roosevelt met in Casablanca in February, and Churchill continued on to Cairo to the overview of the crucial military strategy. Rommel and the German Desert Fox was fighting the British 8th Army and the Americans in Tunisia. Field Marshal Montgomery was sharpening his claws for the final Allied battle against the Germans in North Africa. Gee, the Aussies did a big fight against him at El Alamein. It was just an incredible battle. Gee, a lot of the actual battle went because Australians took the initiative. With the British troops stretched from Gibraltar across the Mediterranean, India into Africa, there's strong pressure from Stalin for a second front. Churchill, judging the multifarious duties as the Prime Minister and Minister of Defence, overseeing strategy, planning, military and civilian efforts, determined the critical allocation of resources between the home front and many theatres of war, turned his lively mind to another subject. At the end of February 1943, Churchill cabled the Australian Prime Minister John Curtin with an unusual request. Would he send 6 live platypus as soon as possible to the United Kingdom? Churchill was already an admirer of the grace and beauty of the Australian black swans. Half a dozen of these presented to him in 1930, swam contentedly about the lake in his country home, Cartwell. Bad news had reached him of the 2 platypuses, Jack and Jill. At Healesville, David Fielding was hence vastly surprised in March 1943 to receive a visit from 2 hatted officials from the Commonwealth Department of Health, where Churchill's request had been conveyed, bearing the news of his proposed wartime mission. It was hush-hush, with no preceding correspondence to explain it, and the orders for a total ban on any media coverage. It was, Fielding admitted, a shock of a lifetime. Whether it was interpreted as a good boost to British morale or a splendid propaganda diversion, we never knew, he recorded. Yet he imagined any man, Fielding reflected, carrying the responsibilities of Churchill did with humanity on the rack of Europe and Asia, finding time to think about, let alone want half a dozen duck-billed platypuses from Far West Australia. Yet no matter how scared the platypus might be, a protected species in every state, Churchill had spoken, and the business would be attended to. Indeed, might not the platypuses become urges for more planes and guns? Minuscule beavers were calling the punching Canadian Lord Beaverbrook, who, in the Ministry of Aircraft Production during the Battle of Britain, had successfully galvanised the women of Britain to offer up the aluminium saucepans to get more planes into the air. What? So let's look at Lord Beaverbrook from Canada. Whatever the motive, the platypus would go to war, and despite his amazement, David Fleury was a man for the task. Neither Jack or Jill were to be the answer to Churchill's call. Their day for fame came later. Nonetheless, he played a timely part in introducing and masterminding officials to the animal's nervous and secretive ways. They, at least succeeded in convincing the severe visitors from the health department that the idea of 6 captured platypus freshly taken from the wild and housed on a ship for transportation to Britain was not a goer. No living platypus had ever reached any part of Europe, though impregnated bottled specimens and skins had poured in large consignments. Freely a man in the hot seat made his conditions. He would capture several young platypus, select the single best candidate, design a portable home for the long sea journey. At the time, a crew member with the affinity for animals would be given a crash course by Fleary on the appointed platypus keeper for the voyage. Experienced Fleary caught his young male platypus from the tributary of the Yarra River in 43, and an appropriately named the beady-eyed Winston came to the honour of the national guest. Gingerly cared for and fed on lavish bill of fare paid for by the Curtin government. Informed of his namesake and unaware of the difficulties involved, Churchill was impatient of the delay. Visiting Washington for crucial talks with President Roosevelt in May that year, he communicated with Dr. H.V. Evatt, the Australian Minister of Foreign Affairs, also on a mission in Washington, to speed things along. Evatt terse cablegram to Australia's Foreign Affairs representative in Canada, in Canberra, for transmission to the Commonwealth Director General of Health, Dr. Crumpston, read simply, Churchill at Washington, most anxious that platypus should leave immediately. What is the present situation? However, it was not until September 43, 4 months after the arrival at Healesville, that the young Winston was ready to take up residence in a terrifying platypus ring, and then not without some misgiving at the organist's part. Built with the utmost secrecy by the government, his new habitat, over and above the usual features supporting a swim tank equipped with baffles to overcome the water roll and the waterproof lead-in barrows. Late in September 43, after several months of covert preparation, Winston sailed to Melbourne on the MV Port Phillip, bound to the Quoxock wartime assignment. The ship was well prepared, equipped, as Fleary noted, with enough earthworms, crayfish, mealworms, fresh water to have refueled Winston for a complete round-the-world voyage. Merchant vessel Port Phillip sailed across the Pacific through the Panama Canal and submarine infested Atlantic Ocean in Britain. Sir Winston Churchill made arrangements with the Royal Zoological Society of London for the reception of the Australian operative. Almost through the Arctic, a thriving and healthy Winston was feeding ravenously. Within 4 days' sail of England, disaster struck. The ship's sonar detected the presence of a submarine. The rapid discharge of discharges from the sounding waters saved the ship and her men, but the jarring detonation instantly killed the platypus. His highly sensitive, nerve-pocketed bill, designed for complex sense organs to detect the smallest insects at the bottom of the river and respond to the slightest vibrations of the natural world, was unable to deal with the violent explosions of men. So the Germans killed our bloody platypus. God. By coincidence, in October 43, Winston journeyed on his historic fiddling. Jill Platypus began gathering material for the nesting burrow after mating with the now familiar Jack. Started to construct a nursery under the fascinated eyes of the spectators. After eggs were laid, she blocked her burrow with several plugs at the end for a long wait. Notable for Jill's intensive eating, Fleary and staff dug into the burrow on January 44 and excavated one fat, wrinkled platypus. They named it Corrie, the first platypus to be born in captivity. She was soon a major media event. Corrie's birth resonated in Britain, and Australia gained some of the liveliest publicity since the Battle of El Alamein. In the thick of war, the clearly ruffled London Daily Telegraph republished the local Ray Mr. Verse in their columns. Hush-a-bye platypus, pride of the zoo, baby shall figure in the natural world, nature's hoo-hoo. Mummy will fondle and daddy will brag, while the zoologist's tongues are away. Shh, little mammal. You're not all that smart. This is no time to expect a star's part. Sleep and remove that smirk off your bill. We are making more history than you ever will. Oh, the Australian jungle fighters huffed the paper with doubtless agree. Late 45, at the close of the war, Field Marshal Lord Allenbrooke, wartime chief of the Imperial Staff, visited Melbourne as well this afternoon, enjoying the fauna of Healesville Sanctuary. Allenbrooke cuddled the 2-year-old Corrie. It was the first encounter of a live platypus. His only previous contact with the animal, he told Fleury, had been with a mounted specimen in Winston Churchill's desk. Winston had reached his destination.
Oh! Now, isn't that classic? So, what a classic story. Hopefully. Yeah. Even though that's a 10-minute episode, thing, I'll stop it there, because the next one is a lineup. In terms of what a classic story. What happened to Winston? Well, he died and got stuffed and put on his desk. What an amazing story. And this is the last chapter here of a marathon, and hopefully I'll be able to read it, but I'll put these two up now while they're fresh in my memory. And that's only given me half an hour, or no, about 40 minutes of reading. The next one will be another, how many pages? 186 to 205, another 20 pages, so that's really the last of it going across. Well, what a spectacular story. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.